the studios of KUSP Santa Cruz. I'm Gary Shapiro with From the Bookshelf. Rachel Duwaskin is my guest. Her first book was the memoir, Foreign Babes in Beijing, Behind the Scenes of a New China, which brilliantly described her experiences as the star of a Chinese soap opera. Her new book is an absolutely wonderful novel called Repeat After Me. Rachel Duwaskin, welcome to From the Bookshelf.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Before we talk about your novel, which is great, let's just review for our listener. You went to China and you became the most famous woman in the country.
Well, that's a very generous way of putting it. I went to China when I was 21 on a whim because I had spent a lot of time learning Chinese characters in college. And I went at a moment when there weren't that many young Western women living there. And so this friendly producer asked me, please, to be in his soap opera called Foreign Babes in Beijing. He essentially saw me at a party and was like, you're white, do you want to be in my show? And that was my beautiful path to stardom.
And what was your character's name? I can't say it.
Jessie. It's just it's a transliteration of Jessie.
Ah. And what kind of a girl was she?
She was the bad girl. She was the vixen. We used to joke that it was Vixen in China. It was like Nixon in China, except a little bit less profound. The show was very standard kind of soap opera fare. It was about a good girl who was played by a blonde German girl, although she was meant to be American in the script, and a bad girl. And both girls, I played the bad girl, both of us fell in love with, you know, virile, macho, People's Liberation Army poster boy Chinese men. It was a show about the West falling in love with China.
Now, you speak Chinese then, I assume.
I do. I speak Chinese, although my Chinese was pretty... It was pretty remedial at that point.
Well, in the clip that I saw, it looked like you were dubbed anyway.
Everybody was dubbed. It was actually really funny. You know, I was a kind of a goody-two-shoes, and I worked really hard to get the dialogue right, not realizing that it was a low-budget kind of thing, and they didn't have the technology to do simultaneous sound.
Oh, so they just looped everything.
Right, so I worked really hard, and then I got dubbed by this woman who did a very kind of high-pitched, cutesy voice, and I felt artistically devastated.
Was it the same woman who dubbed you every week? Or was it every day? How often was the show on the air?
You know, it's interesting. It's actually something of a misnomer to call it a soap. It was more of a miniseries because in China they like to air things. They like to censor things, you know, quite aggressively. So they try to avoid filming and airing simultaneously. So what they did was they filmed the entire thing over kind of a six-month period.
And then
they could censor the script, and then they could censor the entire miniseries once it was in the can, and then they aired it.
Well, what kinds of things what did they censor?
It's funny you should ask that. I asked that question many, many times, and I was never able to get quite the straight answer I wanted. I know that there were scenes... We argued about various scenes in the script, and some of them were sort of toned down a bit. So, for example, there was a scene in the show in which some Chinese people were burning imported old clothing. It was implied that the clothing had come to China from the West, and ostensibly they were burning it because it was infected with AIDS. And we felt like that wasn't, you know, it wasn't the most responsible way to depict AIDS or the, you know,
right,
how people get AIDS.
Right.
So they took that out.
That was nice.
But that was the only real revision I ever heard about. It not being censored was a source of pride for the producers.
I see.
It was
to get
considered
past
kind of criticism if things got cut. So the way they presented it to me, nothing ever got cut from the show because they knew well what to include and what not to.
Well, what kind of sex was on the show?
Well, I opened my memoir, Foreign Babes in Beijing, with the sexiest scene from the show, which was one of the most unsexy experiences of my life since I was the one filming it. It was a scandalous love scene between me and my married Chinese lover. But my vocabulary was so bad at the time that when Director Yao said things like, drop your pants, for example, I had to look up each individual syllable he had spoken to understand what he was talking about. Or he said, claw his back, but I took that to be rub his back. So things like, there were slight nuanced misunderstandings which made the scene perhaps less sexy than it was intended to be. But once it aired on Chinese television, I would say it was pretty tame compared to Western television. I mean, there was certainly no nudity, for example. There was implied nudity. You could tell that we were supposed to be having sex, but it wasn't. There was nothing graphic about it.
Yeah. What kinds of costumes did they put you in?
I wore long fur coats, two fur coats sewn together, and I wore a lot of dangling rhinestone jewelry. And I expressed at some time dismay over this because, you know, my character was supposed to be, although lascivious, a foreign exchange student. And I did at some point say to the costumers, you know, this is not, incidentally, how foreign exchange students or any American girls I know dress. And they said, we don't care what you think. This is what the Chinese audience wants to see. You know, you look like Dallas.
So in that way, it's
which is an interesting lesson to me because, you know, stereotypes of Western women don't originate actually in the Chinese imagination. They come from Hollywood exports. They come from Baywatch. They come from Dallas. I mean, everybody in China in the 1990s had seen Dallas, but many people had never seen a Western woman.
Well, so and people stopped you on the street and followed you home and all kinds of things?
People bought whatever condiments I was buying in grocery stores. Chinese people are very friendly. You know, I had a great, great life there. People were very warm. Even after the show was famous, it just intensified with what was already the reality of my life there as a foreigner, which was that people wanted to have a conversation with me. And I think that's still true for foreigners living in China. Chinese people are very good hosts, you know. They feed you, they encourage you to speak Chinese no matter how badly you're doing it, and they want to have a conversation about the world, cab drivers, people in the streets. So once I was in Foreign Babes in Beijing, people felt like I had been in their homes. They felt like I was the person who visited their living rooms nightly, in fact, because the show was on every night for 5 years. Even though there were only 21 episodes, they just continued airing
it
in an endless loop. Not, I think, because we were spectacular, but because it had very little competition in the way of entertaining fare on television.
But you didn't stay and pursue a career there. You could have been a movie star or whatever. They paid you.
I don't know if I could have been a movie star. I mean, my acting was really shudder-worthy, I have to say. I mean, I'm not a professional actress, and I didn't think that mattered when I signed up to do the soap because I, like many people, thought that acting was just something that you could do.
Right.
But it turns out real training and talent are required. You
Who
can
knew?
See clips of Foreign Babes in Beijing on the internet, and I think my acting really speaks for itself.
So after the show was over, you came home or you stayed in
China? Oh, no. I stayed in China for many years. I spent most of my 20s there, and I still, in fact, have an apartment there. I'm back and forth at least once a year, sometimes more. I spend my summers there now. I spend a lot of time hanging out with my Chinese friends and thinking about China.
Well, so you wrote your memoir, Foreign Babes in Beijing, and then you came home and you became famous here in America on talk shows. And what was that like, you know, when the press was crazy?
You know, it was really nice. I took the enthusiasm over the book, Foreign Babes in Beijing, as a kind of sign that Americans are just really interested in China, and that having somebody who was kind of an accessible guide, meaning me, kind of a young, fresh out of college, Western girl, to talk about China with them made people feel like it was it was not scary, it was not an intimidating place, it wasn't, in fact, even that mysterious. And so I loved the Foreign Babes book tour and the reception of the book, which was quite gracious, I thought, and generous. And I celebrate the books that come out about China because I think people who go and live in other places really do make those countries, they bring other countries closer. We're all getting a little more global, you know? And I think Foreign Babes in Beijing, my book, and the conversations that I had in the West after the book came out were part of that, and I felt really glad to be a part of that.
We're talking with Rachel Dewoskin, if you're just joining us, and she's the author of a couple of books. One that we were just talking about is Foreign Babes in Beijing. So, but there's going to be a movie, right? What happened to the movie?
Yeah, well, you know, Hollywood is apparently making a movie of Foreign Babes in Beijing, the book. They've so far been doing a good job. I mean, they're very thoughtful about who's going to write and who's going to direct and how. And I'm not, you know, that involved with the day-to-day of that project, but I hope it's a sensitive and nuanced depiction. And, you know, my wildest dream for the movie is that it shows what the relationships on the ground between Westerners and Chinese people are actually like. You know, they're very similar to the relationships between Westerners and other Westerners here in the sense that it's not like my Chinese friends and I spend that much time in the culture gap or talking self-referentially about the culture gap. We had very young 20s lives there. We talked about traveling. We talked about studying. We talked about politics. We talked about having kids or not having kids. We talked about sending those kids to college. And it was a very complicated but warm and regular friendships. Like, one of the reasons I wrote Foreign Babes in Beijing was because when I returned to the States in the 2000s, I felt like the conversation here about China sort of reminded me of the Foreign Babes in Beijing presentation of America, in the sense that it was profoundly inaccurate.
So we have it just as wrong as they do, is what you're saying.
Exactly. And it's not wrong. In neither case is it wrong in a mean-spirited way. It's just a kind of stuck in the olden days way. Like, I came back to America and I felt like people seemed to think that China was caught in 1949, that my friends were sort of wearing Mao suits and, I don't know, cultivating pet pandas in their backyards, when in fact they were bearing their midriffs and going to college and graduate school and traveling abroad. And, you know, their aspirations were the same as the aspirations of young people anywhere. They were carving out individual lives. I wrote into that conversation. I mean, I remember once I was in a bank in the Midwest. I'm from Michigan. And the bank teller said to me, "Why do you have a Chinese check?" And I said, "Well, you know, I live and work in China." And she said, "Wow, do the communists ever question you?" And, you know, if the communists had questioned me, I tried to think of what they might ask me, something like, "Are you foreign babes actually as, you know, open-minded as we heard?" But in fact, the communists have much bigger fish to fry.
Yeah.
And China isn't a place where foreigners feel threatened or are threatened. It's a very modern place, and it's quite friendly to foreigners.
Well, how does it compare to, say, is it like New York or what?
I always thought when I lived in China that being in China was a lot like being on a moving floor, and getting home was like getting off that moving floor. And in the sense that China has a very manic pace, you know, everything there is changing. And this is something I worked really hard to capture in the novel, because I love New York City, and I've spent a lot of my adult life here. I went to college in New York. I've now lived in New York for almost 9 more years. But New York is a completed project. It's a beautiful working place. Things kind of already run smoothly. China has a much more rough-hewn feel. You feel like everything is a sort of work in progress because it's modernizing so fast and the transformation is just so staggering. You get to feel when you live there like you're part of something, and there's a tremendous momentum there that's really intoxicating. I think it's one of the reasons that most foreigners who visit China end up going back. Certainly people who live there, my students who go now and spend a semester there, are desperate to get jobs and move back for real. And that happened to me. You know, I moved there with the idea I'd spend a year. I was a kid. I was 21. And I spent 7 years there. Well, and I never left. I mean, I still have an apartment there. I have kids now. I take them every summer for the whole summer.
Hmm. So you've just returned then?
Yeah, I've just gotten back.
Well, so now you have this funny and touching and wonderful work of fiction, Repeat After Me.
Thank you.
And I don't want to give a lot of it away, you know, because I'm really annoyed by reviews or interviews that do that. So I'm going to ask you to just tell us what you think we should know about Repeat After Me.
Repeat After Me is about a Chinese dissident who moves to New York City in 1989 and has a very fraught and complicated romance with his American English as a second language teacher, who's herself a kind of fragile young person. And it's about the year that the two of them spent together in New York, and she narrates the story 13 years later from Beijing, where she's moved to kind of try to figure out who he was. He's by then, you know, no longer in her life. So, you know, one of the reasons I wrote it was because a lot of the things I imagined and the conversations I wanted to have about China and the questions I wanted to ask weren't organic to a nonfiction project. I mean, Foreign Babes in Beijing, I was tethered in that book to fact. I tried very hard to be accurate, since I was writing about dates and people and, you know, my friends and politics and a lot of things that, you know, could be fact-checked both by me and by others. And so there were some forbidden liberties. I didn't, for example, make composite characters, even though I longed to. I didn't make myself more likable or my friends sexier or more interesting than they actually were, even though I wanted to. And so I saved some of those freedoms for the fiction. And in Repeat After Me, I got to create people who embodied the most interesting things I had ever observed in other people and who said the things I wanted said in the world and asked the questions I wanted asked. And that was a very thrilling experience. And nonfiction is thrilling as well, although in a slightly different way. I think creating a novel and making up the rules of a world and then living by those rules and watching your characters live by those rules is very exciting.
Well, and you seem to have some fun in a loving way, in the same way that you did in Foreign Babes in Beijing, with the language, both Chinese learning English and American learning Chinese, especially when you were talking about the funny, I don't know how to put it, the misused Chinese words.
It's my favorite thing. I mean, I take more joy in Chinglish, which is a kind of messy hybrid of English and Chinese, than in almost anything else. And, you know, I taught years ago in Taiwan, I taught ESL. And, of course, the protagonist of Repeat After Me is an ESL teacher. So anyone who's ever taught English can appreciate why there's a kind of clarity to the language that's spoken by people who don't speak it fluently that you never get from a native speaker. And my all-time favorite example is a poem that I included in Repeat After Me called The Stupid Jeff. I had two students one summer, one named Martin and the other named Jeff. And Martin wrote this, they were 11-year-old Taiwanese boys, and Martin wrote this poem about Jeff called The Stupid Jeff, and it's the funniest thing I've ever heard in my whole life, and I loved it. I love Chinglish mistakes, even my own mistakes. I mean, I've made terrible mistakes in Chinese. Because Chinese is tonal, when you say something wrong, it isn't as if you've said nothing, but in fact you've said something else. So, for example, I once said on the set of Foreign Babes in Beijing that the Chinese teachers at Columbia, where I went to undergraduate school, are very strict. But it turns out that if you slightly mispronounce strict, which is yenge, and you say yenge, it's not strict, but castrate. So I had said to a large crowd of rubberneckers and my co-star, this, you know, macho Chinese guy, that the Chinese department at Columbia castrates its students. So things like that. So, I mean, I have perspective. I'm generally the one making the mistake. But the stupid Jeff, the assignment was to write a poem that rhymed. That was the whole assignment. And I read my kids Shel Silverstein, and this kid, Martin, wrote this poem, which I immediately memorized and have spent 18 years thinking and laughing about. And it went, the stupid Jeff are having coughs. He cutting medicine into half. The stupid Jeff are playing golf. He hitting ball onto roof. The stupid Jeff are playing in fall. He eat the leaf and then he barf. And they're consonant rhymes. And I found them just amazingly subtle and funny. And I felt like that poem, it expressed the kind of ambiance of that summer in a way that nothing else they wrote, none of the academic essays, and certainly none of the things that I said or wrote about the summer or teaching them could possibly have gotten at the heart of.
Well, so it's very funny. But how much of Repeat After Me then, you know, draws on your own experience? So you had the ESL and you've been to China, but what else?
A lot of it. You know, I think one of the questions that's come up a lot on my book tour for the novel has been this question about what was the difference between writing Foreign Babes in Beijing and writing Repeat After Me. And I've said a little bit already about why I wanted to do fiction after having written a nonfiction book. But in large part, the two projects are quite similar. In a craft sense, in each project, I took a huge amount of information and a lot of observations and thoughts, and I tried to cull from them what was interesting and moving and, you know, in some cases, hopefully profound, and to make them propulsive in terms of plot and to make them, you know, to make meaning out of the mess of what a life is. And the material for Foreign Babes in Beijing, of course, came directly from my real life and from my journals and from the lives of my friends. And, the material in Repeat After Me came in large part from those things as well, although the project of organizing that material was slightly different because the constraints were different. Both projects were how to put something together that's beautiful out of something that's, you know, messy and a little bit incoherent. I mean, my life, unfortunately, hasn't been, you know, three-act structure. There hasn't been a fabulous narrative arc. And in a way, even Foreign Babes in Beijing is an unorthodox book in the sense that I don't begin it as a kind of innocent babe in the woods and end as a woman of the world, partially because that didn't happen, and partially because I don't like those kinds of memoirs. And Repeat After Me also has a very unusual structure. I mean, I have the two years running underneath each other.
Yeah. The time slips, or whatever you want to call them. Well, did you know you were going to write a novel always, or was it like after Foreign Babes in Beijing? It was like, what next? Or did you have this story in your head?
You know, I had the people in the story in my head. I kind of had this girl, this fragile, somewhat shaken girl living in New York City, which I was not at the time, actually. I was living in Boston when I thought of the book. And I put her story together in my mind, and I put him in, because he was a composite of many people I've known, including me. I mean, one of the funny things about the novel is that everybody in it is a part of me, right?
Right.
I think all the dialogue comes from the inside of my mind. But, of course, the landscape of my imagination is also just a buffet of sort of things I've heard and thought and found interesting and observed over the years. So, in a way, that's a kind of nonfiction. I mean, it's a kind of truth. Both books are looking for something that's true. Although I think my books, in a way, I try when I'm writing my books to ask questions rather than answer them. I struggled with that in Foreign Babes because it was nonfiction, and I felt while I was writing it as if I've said nothing large, if I've come to no general conclusions and exposed no enormous life-changing truths, then what have I said? But later I consoled myself because I feel in some ways like answering questions, it isn't exactly the work of writers. It's the work of propagandists. And the work of an artist or a writer is about asking questions. And once I had come to that conclusion, I felt like I felt free to write a novel. I felt very good about working on something that was my expression of what's meaningful in the world, or my way of looking at the world and finding things that matter in it.
Well, it's a love story, but it's also a story about the relationships of women to each other and about family relationships.
Right. I mean, for me, a love story is it's thin if it's just a romance. Like, the love stories in my life are about my mom, whom I adore, and my dad, and they're about my grandparents and grandchildren. Now that I have babies, these are relationships I observe all the time, and I think they're quite shatteringly important and beautiful and profound. And there's an idea in America about the relationships between women that I really balk at. It's a kind of be Hollywood backlash idea that women are in constant competition with each other for all sorts of things, for limited positions of glory or for men or for whatever the goal is. You see this in movies all the time and in after-school specials and in books and all over the place in our pop culture. And that hasn't been my experience. My experience in life has been that my relationships with women are tremendously important and are life-sustaining, and that many of my best friends are women, and that those relationships are hugely positive. And that's something I wanted to show politically, because I think it's important for little girls to see that. Like, I have two little girls, so this is something I spend some time thinking about. And I wanted to show that, and that moms and their daughters all often adore each other. I mean, obviously, we all have strife and stress, and relationships are complicated, and they take real work. But Repeat After Me is in large part about the ways that we love each other and the ways that we forgive each other, even when we get it wrong. It's about the finding and losing that are required of being a person in the world.
So did you always know you were going to be a writer, or has writing just kind of grown out of your experiences?
No, I always wrote. I remember my first diary. My big girl just turned 5 yesterday, and she got her first diary. It's a little fancy diary with a lock. And I remember my first one was a Hello Kitty diary. It had a little lock, and I fastidiously locked it every night, and I wrote the details of my life, which, of course, were, you know, obscenely banal. I've now read that diary. I was 7. It's all about playing floor hockey and gym and whether Andy said hi to me, this kind of thing, in the hallway. But I've kept track of my life as I lived it every minute my entire life since I was 7. And writing was always important to me. It was always important not only to get everything down, but to get it right, to make the shapes of the sentences sound good, and to listen to the way words sounded.
So do you have a couple more novels in you? I mean, are you going to continue?
I do. I have my next book's actually finished. I'm about to send it out.
Oh, wow.
I'm pretty excited about it.
Send one to me.
Teenage little person growing up in the Midwest.
Oh, so is there China involved in this one? Or?
It's actually not. It's not about China in any way. It's my first book that is in no way about China. And I have a collection of poems, which will come out next year as well, also not about China.
I just read your poem online about the massage parlor.
Yeah.
Everybody
the blind massage parlor.
Yeah, everybody should go check that out. That's very funny.
Thank you. You found that on my website or on the literary journal?
On your website, yes.
Okay, great.
Very funny. And so you occasionally do poetry readings in New York. A New Yorker tells me all the time.
I do sometimes give poetry readings, yeah.
So how is
poetry? Poetry is my first love, in a way.
Yeah, so have you published any books of poetry yet?
I haven't. It's funny. I've published a lot of my poems individually, mm-hmm. and I have now a finished collection of poems. But I've been slow to send that out because poetry for me is I work for much longer on revising individual poems, and it's putting a collection of poems together has been complicated for me. I want the poems to have the right relationship with each other. Like in a novel, creating a plot is its own challenge, of course. But for me, it's much more obvious when a plot is working and when a novel is done, when it's ready, than it has been to tell when a collection of poems is a whole thing. And the poems all work together, and they're exactly the right poems. So I've been much more comfortable over the years publishing individual poems than I have been putting a whole collection out into the world. But I'm about to do that next year. So
next year there'll be a new novel and a new and your book of poetry then.
So, I'm sorry, say that one more time.
I say so. Coming soon will be your new novel and your first book of poetry coming.
Yeah, coming to a theater near you. and by theater, I mean tiny independent bookstore and my website.
I mentioned your website, so let's tell everybody what it's called.
It's just my name. It's racheldewoskin.com.
And it's a wonderful little website, which also includes a little clip of Foreign Babes in Beijing, the Chinese soap opera.
Yes.
Which is a lot of fun. And do you have like a DVD of the whole series and you pull it out and watch it from time to time?
I have watched the show twice in my life. The first time I watched it was when it aired on Chinese television, and I had just read the night before I watched it that it was airing to 600 million viewers. So it's hard to exaggerate how apoplectic I felt. This is so naive, it sounds disingenuous, but when I filmed the soap opera, I just didn't calculate what it meant that it was going to be on TV. For one thing, I was electrified by culture shock. And for another thing, my grasp on language was quite slippery, which sounds like an excuse, but in fact, I hadn't read the script. So it's a huge understatement to say that I hadn't considered the moral nuances of the show or what I had gotten involved in. And I was the star. So when it aired, I was in every episode doing totally ludicrous things and saying shocking things, including, but not limited to, I love you, what are we waiting for? And things like, what is it with you Chinese guys? Can't you love anyone other than your wives? And so watching it on Chinese TV with 600 million other people, I suddenly thought, what have I done? What is this show and how does it end and what is it going to mean? I mean, I had barely kept up with the dialogue in terms of what we filmed that day. I had a tutor on the set with me helping me get the lines right, but I hadn't read ahead. I couldn't conceivably have followed the plot. The reading, just getting my own dialogue sequences was as much work as I could possibly manage. So I was really nervous. That said, the happy ending is that I think actually the show ended up being quite complicated in the sense that it seemed on the surface of it to be a criticism of foreign women, but in fact, I think in a large sense, it was an advertisement for Western liberties and Western girls. You know, I think the final sequences of me and the love of my life leaving forever, leaving for America, having sacrificed everything for true love, and it's a scene of inevitable exodus, not one, I think, of xenophobic remorse. His parents embrace me. I call them mom and dad, and we fly off to a glistening life in the West. And the good girl, also American, stays in China with his brother. So China benefits enormously. They get the West's best assets in this girl who stays there, and they get to export a Chinese man to America, which is good. They would never, incidentally, have shown the opposite situation, that is, a Chinese woman and a Western man. That's way too contentious and fraught.
Do you still hear from Chinese fans? Do they write you or...
Most of the people who write me now are people who have read or heard about the books.
Right.
I don't usually, when I'm in China, I get the hi Jessies sometimes on the street still from people who watched the show back in the day. And in fact, this summer, a couple of people told me they had seen the show, that it's re-airing in certain far-flung provinces. But mainly, if I have, I mean, I don't know if you can call them fans, kind people who read my books write to me via the website, which is always really nice. And many of those people are Chinese.
Oh,
many of the people who write me are Chinese, yeah.
Well, our guest is Rachel Dewoskin, and her books are the one we've been talking about extensively, which is Foreign Babes in Beijing, Behind the Scenes of a New China, and the one that you are all about to read. It's a wonderful, wonderful novel, and it's called Repeat After Me. And Rachel, you're going to come back soon and talk about your new novel.
I hope you'll have me again. I really appreciate it.
That's all the time we have for this week's edition of From the Bookshelf. Hope you enjoyed the program. I'll be back again next week with another great show. In the meantime, check us out on Facebook or iTunes or our podcast page at KUSP.org. I want to thank our From the Bookshelf staff, Miss Breanne Beale, for all of her hard work. Thanks, Breanne. For KUSP and From the Bookshelf, I'm Gary Shapiro. See you next time.